You're listening to the Vegans Explore Network, found at vegansexplore.com.
Welcome back to another episode of the Vegans Explore podcast. Today, I have a special guest with me, and she's special for the fact that we haven't really gone deep into this topic. Meanwhile, it is a huge part of the animal rights movement. Without the work that our guest has done, we wouldn't be able to make the progress that we're making right now as a movement. So I'm so excited to have you on the podcast. And of course, our guest is Gail Eisnitz, who is a author. We get to talk all about her book, Out of Sight, An Undercover Investigator's Fight for Animal Rights and Her Own Survival. So thank you so much for providing me with a book. A copy of your book, which is out right now. You guys can get a copy. We'll talk about all that at the end, where you can get your own copy and read her story. But we will be going over a lot of that. Not everything, because we do want to leave a few things for the book, so make sure you guys go ahead and check it out. But we'll be talking about a lot of the topics that she covers in the book in this podcast. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Wow, thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
So I like to typically kick things off with people giving people a little bit of a background behind the person that we're speaking to, just so they can understand everything else that we're talking about. We could call it our vegan origin story. So basically give us an idea of how you personally got started on your vegan journey.
It all began when I was 14 years old and I saw a documentary on TV in which a mother polar bear was shot and her two cubs were left behind, and they were scared. They were so scared, they didn't know what to do. And it just hit me really deeply, and it set me on my journey to do animal protection. And then my vegan journey started as I did investigations, and the more I found out about the animals I was investigating, the less I ate those animals. So it's been quite a while since I've been investigating. So I've been a vegan for quite some time.
So take us, that's huge, the investigation part. I've had an opportunity to speak to and be around a few investigators. I know it's not something you just pick up and do tomorrow. There's a lot of thought that goes into it, a lot of safety precautions. There's a lot of things that can happen when you decide to do animal abuse investigation. So take us into what did that look like for you? I know you mentioned just a moment ago what kind of brought you to that, but what was next? How did you move forward with that? Like, take us through your whole process. What was that like?
Sure. Well, I mean, I pretty much pounded the pavement for years trying to get a job in the animal protection business. And since I had been writing, I wrote for the New York Times for some pieces on animal protection, and I was finally hired by the Animal Welfare Institute in Washington, D.C. And eventually I was hired by Humane Society of the United States and then Humane Farming Association, where I'm chief investigator now. There was no training when I switched from writing to investigations. There was no training. It was all just we were flying by the seat of our pants, and we were able to get some incredible information. I started my investigative journey doing all sorts of different animal issues, but ultimately when I received a complaint about cows having their heads skinned while they're still fully conscious at a slaughterhouse down in Florida, that started my big investigative journey into slaughterhouses and factory farms, which I've focused on now for many years.
Wow. That was when you said what you just said, is like put a picture into my head. And I feel like that not shying away from the reality, the atrocities that are happening in these slaughterhouses and saying it as it is important, because you want to create that visceral feeling when people hear about it, because it's not just as simple as putting a slab of hamburger meat on your grill. There is serious torch. That's torture. You know, it goes far beyond, you know, the term humane slaughter. Like, to me, I never got that term, because that's, but anyways, we're getting away from the point. You know, you shared how your investigative background, you work for some prestigious institutions. we're talking about, and this is the interesting thing about when it comes to factory farming and these sort of practices, I've heard a similar sentiment, not just from the vegan community or an animal rights community, but even from hunters. It's like one of those topics that you find that cross section where you know, you would think that they might be on the opposite side of this, but I feel like there's a lot of support and rallying behind the treatment of animals in these facilities. What has been your experience? Because you have way more of a pedigree when it comes, bad choice of words. You have way more of experience when it comes to this arena. What has been your impression when it comes to the cross sections of all these different communities when it comes to this particular topic?
Well, I guess hunters basically rationalize their hunting because they know that conditions inside factory farms are so deplorable. So that's a rationale to them. I wouldn't buy it, but I also wouldn't buy food from factory farms. conditions in the factory farms we've investigated have been atrocious. I mean, we can get into some of those in more detail if you like, but between the slaughterhouses and the factory farms that I've investigated, I tend to talk about violations because I don't want to turn people off, but they really are atrocities.
Let's go into it. You know, let's go into some of the things that you found that might shock people in terms of the violations in particular.
Well, just to give a little background on the slaughter side of it, we're talking about really fast production line speeds where they disassemble the animals. They're so fast that they can't ensure that the animals are rendered unconscious, as is required by law. And the speeds we're talking about are like one hog every 3 seconds in an individual plant. One of the plants I visited slaughters 35,000 pigs a day. So those are really fast. And for poultry, which aren't even covered by the Humane Slaughter Act, they're exempt from the Humane Slaughter Act. We're talking, it used to be 140 birds were eviscerated per minute. And now it's going to be 175 birds eviscerated per minute. That's 3 birds per second. Mm. So it's important to bring that up to sort of validate why we see so many violations. The bottom line is a minute of downtime in the production process spells a loss of hundreds or thousands of dollars. So the line never stops because they don't want to lose the money. And it doesn't stop for anything. It doesn't stop for injured workers. It doesn't stop for contaminated meat. And it definitely doesn't stop for slower, uncooperative animals.
So you mentioned something important, which you just said. It sounds like there has been an increase in the production of the slaughter of these animals. What have you noticed in terms of when you first started investigating to now? Has this been a gradual increase, or, you know, has it happened at a certain period of time? What have been some of your findings?
Well, one thing that's worth mentioning is that 55 years ago, we slaughtered 10 billion animals in the world. And today we slaughter 10 billion animals a year in the United States alone. So you can imagine things have gotten worse. I documented all sorts of violations, and I interviewed workers and meat inspectors who had spent a combined total of 3 million hours on the kill floor. And they said, now this was years ago because this was my first book, and I'll tell you what happened after that. But they said without exception, they either engaged in or observed animals being strangled, beaten, boiled, skinned, or dismembered while fully conscious. But fortunately, I was able to get this information on the front page of the Washington Post, and U.S. Congress saw the article and was absolutely outraged, and they decided to fund the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act, which had been on the books for 43 years, but had never been funded. So they decided to fund enforcement of it. But that said, even though now there's funding to enforce the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act, it's only less than 3% of the federal meat inspection budget goes toward humane slaughter enforcement. So that's a terrible number.
Out of curiosity, when was this act enabled? And yeah, when was this act enabled? I'm curious.
It was passed in 1958, so 68 years ago. And it was funded in 2001 as a result of the Washington Post story.
And do you see anything, any movement towards there being more funding or more support behind this legislation, or do you feel like it's kind of stagnated?
Well, I think it's they add more inspectors every year to do what are called verification procedures. That means spot checks into the areas of the plants where the animals are supposed to be stunned. Just spot checks. And in my opinion, spot checks don't really work because workers know that the inspectors are coming into the area. They have code words and whistles, and they have handheld radios to say that the inspector's coming into the area. So spot checks, I don't think, work, but they keep doing more spot checks. But again, it's only less than 3% of the budget. And I feel that inspectors, meat inspectors who are stationed in the plants inspecting meat, who are supposed to enforce the Humane Slaughter Act, I feel that they should be stationed on a full-time basis in the areas of the plants where the animals are handled and slaughtered.
So how often are they actually doing these spot checks? How much time throughout the year are they doing these spot checks?
They do the spot checks every day, several times a day, but it's not like having somebody stationed there on a full-time basis.
Gotcha. And you've mentioned the violations and you've gone over some of the abuses, but how are you seeing it on the factory farms? How are you seeing, can you describe some of these abuses that are happening to the hogs, chickens, the dairy cows on these factory farms?
Well, we found that in the places we investigated, there was only one employee for every 2,000 animals. So you can imagine on hog factories. So you can imagine the types of violations that occur. Piglets that don't make weight or runts or are sick are thumped, which means that the workers take the pigs by their hind legs and whirl them over their shoulders and smash them head first to the concrete floor. And they also have another acronym for that. It's PACT, pound against concrete. And it's American Veterinary Medical Association approved, which is that's because the American Veterinary Medical Association is in bed with the producers, the farming industry, the agricultural industry. But we've seen little piglets get their little feet stuck in spaces between the slats on the floors and actually starve to death because they can't move. And we've seen them get stuck under heat lamps, brooders, where they bake to death. The workers said they could smell their bodies when they came into work in the morning. And the workers, this is so common, the workers had nicknames for it. They called them crispy critters, dead bacons, and baby back ribs. That's what they called these poor dead piglets. And for the larger pigs, in some of these operations, if they were sick or fallbacks, they would be beaten to death with hammers and wrenches and gate rods. Or workers actually admitted to standing on their throats to suffocate them. And one worker put a water hose into the hog's mouth and watched it as it's what he said was his butt popped out. I mean, these are just a few of the things. One of the big problems on these big factory farms, the conditions are so that the animals are so deprived of any type of stimulation or or even ventilation has an impact on them, all sorts of things. They engage in cannibalism. And that means they start with the ears or the tail, and they actually eat the hind ends and faces off of the animals. We have videotape of this, animals with their faces half gone. And the workers had nicknames for the remnants of these hogs because they were just, it was so common, they made nicknames. They called them, they were just hide and bones. They called them rugs.
Mm-hmm. Rugs.
And then, you know, we have videotape of piglets swimming in the frigid waste pits, and they end up dying, drowning, or flushed out into the manure lagoons. The worst thing, I think, are the gestating pigs, the pregnant sows. That everybody's heard of gestation crates, where they are confined in crates that are 2 feet wide by 7 feet long. In some of the operations we investigated, they're only 19 inches wide. These animals are 400 to 600 pounds, and they're in 19 inch wide crates. So they're in constant contact with the crate bars, and they get sores on their face, on their heads, on their shoulders, on their backs, their legs, their hindquarters. They get these great big sores that go untreated. They engage in stereotypies, which is what people with clinical psychiatric problems do. They engage in head bobbing, air chewing, and bar biting. They often collapse in their crates and starve to death or die of dehydration because they can't stand to reach the water nozzle. And then they're just dragged alive or dead into the dead pile. And dead trucks pick them up on their daily rounds, take them to the rendering plant. So one operation that had to give up its numbers of dead pigs on the farm in 1 year, it had to provide that information because it was a subject of an investigation by the Department of Environmental Protection, because the dead boxes were overflowing and the dead hogs were littering the ground. And the Department of Environmental Protection thought that it was going to seep into the groundwater. Mm. So they cited them, and they had to give the number of dead pigs at that big corporation. And in that year, that 1 year, they lost 420,000 dead pigs on farm. That's not slaughter. That's on farm. So that's pigs.
Wow.
But I can tell
you. Let's keep going. I mean, this, I think it's important for people to hear this because it's happening.
Right. It is happening. It's really tragic. Chickens that are raised for meat, broiler chickens, they're extremely crowded, like 50,000 birds in one shed. And they're genetically bred, selected for these massive appetites and for large breasts. So you have a 6.2-pound broiler at 67 weeks of age. That's how old they are when they're slaughtered. They're just babies. Is equivalent to a human newborn gaining over 660 pounds in 2 months, in his first 2 months of life. That's how out of whack it is. And that's from a study at the University of Arkansas. So, they're so breast heavy, and we have video of this, that they can't even stand up. Their legs are like splayed out under them, and they can't walk, or they can't stand up. They fall backwards on their backs. They often die of heart attacks because their bodies can't support this massive weight gain. But anyway, and when they fall over, they starve to death if they fall over because their legs can't support them anymore. They're subject to ammonia burns on their breasts from contact with the litter on the ground, which is excrement, straw, and feathers. And there's more about that, but there's so much to talk about that I think I should move on to laying hens. if you want to hear about that.
Yes, please, please.
Okay. You have 300 million male chicks that are useless for laying eggs. So they're ground up or smothered each year in the United States. Everybody's heard about that, I think. As far as caged hens that aren't cage-free, the ones that are actually in battery cages, they cram 6 to 8 hens into cages the size of a microwave. And, of course, they're debeaked with a hot blade when they're chicks, so they don't peck each other in frustration. Their sensitive feet are standing on the sloping wire flooring, and they get osteoporosis and calcium depletion from laying so many eggs in that first year and a half. And the escapees that fall into the waste pits that somehow escape their cages, this has been well documented, they fall into the mire of waste and they get sucked down and they suffocate unless their head is just sticking up above the mire and some animal activist comes in there and rescues them. So that's really bad. I'll tell you just a little bit about beef. It used to take 5 years to finish a steer, but now it's done in 14 to 16 months. They have a very great lack of shade and shelter on these massive feedlots with tens of thousands of cattle, as many as 100,000 cattle on the feedlot. They suffer from lameness and foot rot. They have such a high caloric diet of corn and soy that their livers would blow out after 6 months at the feedlot because their livers can't handle such high caloric diet. And the last thing that I think is really interesting is that they're fed, in addition to corn and soy, they're fed meal from chicken feathers, poultry litter off the floor of poultry sheds, and dead pigs and fish. And then the last animal that we can discuss are dairy cows. They normally produce about less than two gallons of milk naturally to feed their calves. But on these giant dairy mega factories, they produce between 6 and 7 gallons, and at peak times, twice that amount. So they're producing 7 times what they would normally produce. They're pushed so hard metabolically that they're slaughtered at 3 to 5 years instead of the 15 to 20 year lifespan that they would naturally have. They suffer from mastitis, which is an inflammation of the udder, which is really painful. And one operation we saw, the workers were being told to use a razor-like device to cut off a portion of the teat, which is excruciatingly painful. When it was infected. Lameness from urine and manure-soaked concrete floors that they live on. And the last thing is the males, the calves, they can't produce milk, just like the laying hen male chicks can't produce eggs, and the male dairy calves can't produce milk, so they're totally useless to the industry unless they're used for Bob veal, which is slaughtered at 1 to 30 days and is used in hamburger and lunch meat, or milk-fed veal, which most people know are raised in tiny crates and can't turn around for their 5-month confinement, or they're shipped long distances. This is pretty common now, to be raised for cheap hamburger, or they're sold for rendering to be turned into tallow or grease or animal feed. Or, this is what we found, they're simply abandoned on the farm to starve to death, or they're shot, or they're buried alive, or they're beaten to death, what the workers called head bashing. So that's what we found on factory farms.
I'm going to let that sit just for a little bit, because that was a lot, and I'm glad you shared that. And I think what I appreciate about what you shared is I've heard little bits of that, but I've never heard it so comprehensively laid out before to get the big picture of why this movement exists, right. why we do what we do. It's like, you know, we create the correlation between your animal companions and, you know, imagine this happening to them. And you shouldn't need to have that comparison. It's, you know, it's, you see, and I saw something recently that is kind of like, yeah, I mean, the reason we do it to these animals is because they don't fight back.
Yeah.
So if
they could commit suicide, they would.
Yeah. So I've heard a term show up, but I don't have a full understanding of it. What is the idea behind depopulation?
Oh, that's a great question. Depopulation is the large scale on-farm mass killing of animals who are, due to disease or other unforeseen circumstances, can't be shipped to slaughter. So the American Veterinary Medical Association describes it as the rapid destruction of a population of animals in response to urgent circumstances, with as much consideration given to the welfare of animals as practicable. Mm. That is such a big loophole. It's ridiculous. Ventilation shutdown plus is a widely used form of depopulation where they seal up barn inlets. This is usually used for birds, poultry, and for pigs. They seal up barn inlets, shut off the ventilation system fans, heat the barn to triple digits, or pump in added steam, and the animals just bake to death. And that's the way the majority of the almost 200 million poultry, mostly laying hens, but also broilers, have been killed since 2022 to stop the spread of avian influenza. It's just sickening. 200 million birds have been baked alive, and 1 million pigs were killed using Ventilation Shutdown Plus during the COVID outbreak because the workers couldn't work in the plants because they were getting sick, so the plants were temporarily shuttered. And so the pigs that were supposed to go to the plants might get too big. So they killed a million of them by Ventilation Shutdown Plus. They baked them to death. There's also another form of depopulation, which I'll just mention really quickly. It's very commonly used also. It's water-based foam, which is firefighting foam, which they spray into barns and up and over the animals. This is used for chickens and pigs to drown them or suffocate them. And that's a really, really sickening thing.
In line of something you mentioned earlier in terms of the conditions of the animals when they're out in the fields and in the elements where they may die because of the weather and whatnot, I heard that there are tax reimbursements to the farmers in that regard. Why is this a practice, and why is it coming from our tax money to reimburse them?
You and I are paying to support producers who allow their animals to die from exposure to the elements. The USDA has a program called the Livestock Indemnity Program, and it reimburses farmers and ranchers for animals that die in inclement weather to the tune of 75% of the animal's market value. And now, in the big ugly bill in Congress, they're trying to get this passed. It will even include 85% reimbursement for the animal's fetuses. If they have unborn fetuses in them, they get 85% of the fetus's value. So anyway, it's it's a real disincentive to provide the appropriate care for the animals, and it's an enormous waste of taxpayer dollars. So, I mean, enormous waste. Since 2008, we, taxpayers, have spent about $500 million reimbursing farmers for hundreds of millions of dead animals, livestock, and poultry. And so we got legislation introduced in Congress last year, last session, that is, to require producers to have developed and implemented disaster preparedness plans before they ever receive any compensation. But it didn't pass last year because bills don't pass that fast in Congress. We're trying to get it reintroduced in this session. So it's a very reasonable request. It's not very much more than just protect your animals or you don't get a dime of payment.
And I want to bring everything back to the book, where if you're listening to this podcast right now, you're getting a lot of knowledge from someone who's been on the front lines investigating, gathering this information so it can be shared so that we understand the plight of these animals and what's happening right now. So I do have a question regarding the book. Why did you decide to go with a memoir instead of a simple nonfiction book?
It was written as a memoir to get mainstream readers reading it, because I don't want just people who are involved in animal protection to be aware of this information. I want the general public, the consumers, to be aware of it. And so it focuses, it's kind of like a dual book. It uses my life story. It weaves my life story in with some of the types of violations that I mentioned. So that's why.
And when you were out there and you're trying to get these stories out, you've mentioned you've worked with some major publications and media outlets. Do you find there is any hesitation regarding getting them to put the stories out there for them to co-opt a lot of the content that you are putting together?
Any hesitation? There was so much hesitation. It was unbelievable. I worked with all three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. Two of them came out in the field with me, and then all three killed the stories after working for months on them because they said it would be too disturbing to their viewers. I mean, you can show murders and starvation and all sorts of things on the news, but you can't show what consumers are supporting. So they were afraid people would change the channel. That's what they said. It's like the networks are captured by corporate agribusiness. They really are. So that was very discouraging. However, that said, we did an incredibly disturbing case in Ohio where a producer was hanging his sows to kill them, his unproductive sows. They were no longer productive. They had difficulty walking, so he would kick them and prod them and electrically prod them and drag them out of the barn, drop them off a 4-foot ledge, then put a chain around onto a pile of dead and dying sows in freezing temperature, make them watch as they would put a chain around the neck of one of the other ones, and attach the end of the chain to the tines of a front-end loader and lift the fork on the front-end loader, and the sows would struggle for 5 minutes going in circles just suffocating under the weight of their own bodies. And we got videotape of that, and HBO, which was not like CBS, NBC, and ABC, did an hour and a half long documentary called Death on a Factory Farm, exposing the practice and the court battle and everything that resulted from that practice.
And with that being said, when you see this abuse, do you have any trouble working with law enforcement and actually prosecuting some of these cases?
That's for sure. Huge problems. I mean, in the case down in Florida where the cows were having their heads skinned while they were still fully conscious, in our effort to represent the person that gave us that information, who was a USDA employee himself and was fired for going public with this, we took the USDA to court. And as a result of that, the USDA was required to conduct an investigation at the plant. It was the largest cow beef kill in the southeastern part of the United States. And they conducted the investigation. And of course, we won our whistleblower his job back. But the plant, even though it had plans to expand, mysteriously went out of business. And then the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture himself issued the USDA's investigative findings. And they said that the plant was so well run, it was a beautiful operation, and it gave a glowing recommendation. It was no longer operating any longer, so they couldn't prove otherwise, they thought. But I had all these affidavits from a bunch of workers that did prove otherwise. So that was the first encounter I had with corrupt officials. But the governor of Washington, in another cow skinning case, impaneled a task force that was supposed to look at this tremendous dismembering and skinning of cows at the biggest slaughterhouse in Washington state, where we had documented it fully. And workers had provided affidavits, and we had videotape of the cows being skinned alive. And then the governor of Washington and his task force said that Humane Farming Association, who I work for, had orchestrated the evidence for had manufactured the evidence and orchestrated the issue for fundraising purposes. So, and then there were another five or six attorneys general in these different states where we provided evidence at factory farms of some of these violations that I've been talking about. We provided so much evidence. It was overwhelming. We provided photos and video and affidavits. In one case, we provided 800 pages of testimony. And in every case, the attorneys general declined to prosecute because they are captured by corporate agribusiness.
I want to go back a little bit with your memoir. What makes your personal story so unique?
Oh, well, Sean, thanks for asking that question. That's a good question. I have a rare visual processing disorder, and my vision is pixelated, which means I see the world as made up of dots. And at times, I felt like I had dyslexia of the world, where everything was confusing and nothing made sense. Almost like you're looking in a funhouse mirror. And my efforts to expose the animal cruelty that's described in the book take place against my efforts to find a diagnosis for what was a crippling disorder. And so it took me many years to find an answer to that question, because the fact is the disorder wasn't identified in the scientific literature until 10 years ago. Yeah. I lived with it my entire life, and I thought I was crazy. I didn't know what was wrong with me. So I used that story to so that it's not a book just being a book of a litany of horrors of animal abuse. It follows the story of my struggle to find out what is ailing me. And I got my diagnosis 3 years ago, and I won't tell you what it is, but it's revealed at the book's climax. But it makes for good reading, because people are all saying that it's a real page turner. The book is a real page turner, and that they can't put it down. And there's lots of reviews on Amazon.com that say that it's a, well, this one person said, this book reads mostly as a thriller, a suspenseful medical mystery woven into the heroic tale of Gail Eisenitz. And then she goes on and on. And then she says, warning, you will not be able to set her life story down. So that's that that's important to get out, because I don't want people to think that if they read this book, if they get it from the library or buy it on Amazon or wherever, that they're just going to be reading a litany of horrors. The litany of horrors that I provided today are just because I have a short amount of time and I wanted to tell you as much information as I could. But the book's not just like that.
And I'm looking at the book right now, and the top, I think, says it all. From Jane Goodall, shocking, heartbreaking, and full of compassion. I think that last part is an important piece of that, full of compassion. It shows where the heart of this book is. And I definitely feel like if people decide to pick it up, which they should, they will definitely get a story that's not just what, you know, just a list of atrocities that are happening, but a full story that's tied together with your journey. And I think just to find out what that ailment is, what it is at the end is worth the price of admission. So before we wrap up, and we're starting to close down the wrap up the podcast, you did mention a few accomplishments that you were able to achieve from the HBO a documentary. You mentioned a couple of other things. I know there were a few, maybe like one or two others that you wanted to talk about in regards to some of the accomplishments that you've been able to achieve from the work you've been doing?
Yeah, because the book talks about not only the investigations and the documentation, but it talks about, aside from the challenges, it talks about some of our triumphs too. And like I said, I work for Humane Farming Association, and we do everything from anti-cruelty investigations to national media campaigns, one of which is the national veal boycott. And since we started that, running ads all over the country in magazines and newspapers, national magazines and national newspapers, we've seen an 89% drop in veal production. So that's a huge success. Another thing is we were successful in shutting down what was going to be the third largest hog factory in the world. It was located on Rosebud Sioux tribal lands, and it was going to be producing almost 1 million pigs a year. And we were able to use legal avenues to shut that down. So that was really a fantastic victory. We basically stopped all the egregious crimes we've documented, and we shut down a number of operations that we investigated. One thing I'll mention that's really positive is that the Humane Farming Association operates a 7,000-acre refuge, farm animal refuge. It's the largest farm animal sanctuary in the country. So it's a wonderful place, and there's all sorts of animals there. We have like 1,000 animals, everything from chickens and emus to pigs and goats and turkeys and cattle and sheep and burros. We just have a little bit of everything. So it's a wonderful paradise for animals that have been seized as a result of cruelty cases.
And I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to share your story, share your journey, share those, you know, that middle part. I feel like is an important part for people to hear. I'm definitely going to put a disclaimer at the beginning of this podcast, but I urge everyone to listen all the way through, because I think almost like the story, your memoirs, it's, you know, we ended on a note of positivity, like there's hope that, you know, although these things are happening, progress is still being made. I know there are a lot of external factors that play a role in the success of these campaigns. And, you know, even though things may seem, you know, dark right now, things may change, especially as new people shift into the conversation. So we'll definitely look out for that. I definitely want to bring you back on when we do get one of those big sea changes happening in this movement, to get your take on it and have you share exactly what's going on to our community. So thank you for all of the work that you do. And before we officially go, I'd like to give my guest the final word so they can close off the podcast and let people know exactly what's on their heart. you know, there is a piece of it where what we're going to do right now, where you can share, where they can find more information, where they can get the book, where they can, you know, go to your website and even see your other book, The Slaughterhouse. They can get all of that information. So where can they find more information about yourself?
Oh, sure. And I just want to thank everybody who's listening or watching for being vegan. I think it's just fantastic. They can join Humane Farming Association if they want to. That's www.hfa.org. They can go to my website, which is my name, well, www.gaileisnitz.com. They can visit my Instagram page, which is just my name. And that's about it.
And as we close things up, before I turn the floor over to Gail, I want to thank you all so much for being a part of this Vegans Explore journey, for listening to our podcast, this subscribing, leaving reviews if you really love this episode, and sharing. Definitely sharing, letting people know about this message, about what's going on, and going to our page at vegansexplore.com/podcast, where we'll have the show notes, everything, all of the email, the links that Gail just mentioned will be there available for you. So now we get to the end of the podcast, where I am going to turn the floor over to you, Gail, and you can say, we call it a message from the heart, and you are going to officially close the podcast, speaking directly to our audience. Thank you once again, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Sean. I don't have a lot to say. I think I've said quite a bit, but I will say that I think we have some food for thought that makes us realize why we do what we do, why we're vegans, because we don't want to hurt animals and we don't want to support those who are. And I'm just really grateful that you all are vegans and that I'm a vegan, because we're not part of the problem, we're part of the solution.